Welcome to WebRush, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to WebRush. For I think this is show number 196. We're getting so high, I can't even count that high anymore. But it's a good thing because I'm joined here with Dan Wallin, who I believe can count well beyond that. So how are you doing today, Dan?
I'm up to 199, Craig. But
are you?
I don't know what to do after that, man. So
I don't know. We'll have to phone in a friend or something like that.
Yeah, phone a friend. I'll call you, but you don't know. So it's like, we're stuck.
What are we going to do? I know.
That's what guests are
what
for.
What we'll probably need. That's what the guests are for. I was going to say, we probably need some sort of like developer tool that can handle counting or something for us.
Counting.
Yeah.
Just your guy.
That's right. And our guide today is Brian Holtz, who has the distinct honor of being the first guest of this podcast when we were originally known as Real Talk JavaScript. I'd like to introduce him in here. If you're not familiar with Brian, he's currently the PM of DevTools and Dev Experience at Stripe. Before that, he worked on Visual Studio Code, Azure, LinkedIn, Netflix, Reddit, and you know, just places you probably never even really heard of. When not working or playing with his kid, Brian finds time to sweat on the Peloton, play Dota 2 poorly. He wrote it, not me. I don't want to say
jerk.
That. As well as drink plenty of local IPAs and Isla scotches. Did I say that right?
You did.
I did. And enjoys living in Seattle. Brian, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be back.
Absolutely. Yes. So when we're talking about the whole realm of developer tools, I mean, that's a wide gamut that we're talking about. What particularly piques your interest?
I mean, I think as developers, and just me in particular, I like to navel gaze. I'm very into what I want. Strange how that works. And so I like building tools for problems that I have, right? And so it's nice to have that like strong connection to the demographic, right? Like I can go build something and then I can have a problem and then I can think like, okay, I have the power now to go back and solve these problems, right? And you can contrast that with something like maybe if I was building like banking as a service at Stripe, which is, you know, fascinating and very complicated product that Stripe has, but it's not my problem, right? Like I don't have banking as a service needs, right? So I'm just kind of connected to the product and the fact that I'm immersed in it. But I kind of found that niche in particular when I started working at probably Netflix. I started building some of the internal developer tools and started working with our web core team there, which then progressed to being on front end infrastructure at LinkedIn, and then eventually landed at Microsoft working on Visual Studio Code, which is, you know, the developer tool in my opinion. So yeah, I like solving my own problems, I think, is a winding way of saying that.
Right.
So when you say solving problems, are we talking about you're writing extensions for existing things like VS Code? You're writing SDKs, both? What do you actually mean specifically there for solving that problem?
You know, when I have like marital problems or money problems. Like I remember when I joined VS Code, I joined with like a laundry list of things that I was annoyed with, right? So maybe the one of them was that when we used one of the shortcuts to switch to the terminal wasn't fast enough, and so I would hit it and then start typing, and it wasn't quick enough to pick up those first couple of keystrokes, and that annoyed the absolute hell out of me. Can I swear on this podcast? I can't remember. No.
Sure.
No. You can, okay, but don't bleep it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. So I'm going to swear more. Okay. So things that really annoyed me, just from either like those kind of like paper cut kind of things, like, you know, not picking up things, or, you know, I worked on the extensions as well, on VS Code. And so some of that was like, I wish I could complete like the full cloud cycle directly from my IDE, not have to go to the portal, not have to go to a CLI. I could just like build my Node project and then say, put this on Azure. And then like all of that is managed directly from my code editor. And I used to work with, you know, the great team over on the Azure extensions to complete some of those life cycles. So I don't know. Did I answer your question, Dan?
Tell us a little bit about like, so you're at Stripe. There's all of these, like I can only imagine the API surface that's necessary in order to do the type of work and you know, working with payment gateways and all that kind of stuff that comes with banking as a service. But what sort of problems are you seeing that you need to solve in your day-to-day that helps you build those tools now?
Sure. I mean, it's probably helpful to know exactly the scope of what I work on, which is it's funny because sometimes it's so large I can't even remember what it is. So I am the product owner of the Stripe server-side SDKs, the Visual Studio Code extension for Stripe, the Stripe CLI, the React Native SDK, the webhooks experience, some of the docs experiences, the Stripe shell, which is different than the Stripe CLI. If you go to stripe.sh, it'll take you like an online CLI that's built into the browser. And so yeah, and then this is where I start getting into like the long tail things.
Is that all, Brian?
I mean, you're responsible for the everything is basically what it
sort of sounds that way.
I am Stripe. Stripe is just me holding some wires together. No, I mean, it's crazy because we have a ragtag group of great engineers kind of holding all these. Basically, if you're an external developer, how do you interact with Stripe? That's what my team works on.
Gotcha.
So kind of getting into like what my day-to-day and what those kind of things are, a lot of it is just listening to customers, right? So again, I've worked with Stripe before. I actually built the Stripe integration back in like 2014 for Reddit. It was a fantastic experience, and it was actually one of my, you know, one of the things that made me want to join Stripe. But for me, that was the only time I ever used Stripe directly, right? I worked on payments at Netflix as well, so I had some experience with that. But it's going to customers and figuring out like you're using this thing. What sucks about it? What friction do you have? What do your developers wish that was there? Or any, sometimes it's like it's reading between the lines because they don't even necessarily know what they want, right? They just know that the thing that they have that they're unsatisfied with and they want a different thing to go with it. So that's a big part of it. A lot of it's just making sure that my engineers are like working on the things that they want to work on, that they're unblocked and they're not dealing with unnecessary bureaucracy or meetings or things like that. So it's a lot interacting with them. And then a lot of it's just like really fun brainstorming stuff as like, hey, what's really cool developer experiences that we could offer? And it's fun to work at Stripe because Stripe will buy off on like these crazy ideas, like let's build a CLI in the browser, right? So that you can actually manage your Stripe integrations, you know, via command line client without even opening your terminal, right? So sometimes it's just like those kind of wild and crazy ideas as well.
So John, one of the things I like about AG Grid, which is a data grid component for the kind of complex grid scenarios that we encounter all the time in enterprise apps, one of the things I really like about it is that it works for a variety of frameworks, Angular, React, Vue, or just vanilla JS. Does that ring a bell for you?
Oh, it really does. There's all these different companies that I work with where they have no choice but to use a lot of these different tools because they have different teams working on them. So being able to port their code or share that code and that technical investment they have is really important to them.
Yeah, well, it's important to us. Ideally, we're a consulting company, and you know, we never know what our client's going to want to use, Angular, React, or Vue, but they're all going to need a grid, and it's great to be able to reach for the one grid that works everywhere, AG Grid.
You know what, and any size company too, because you could have these teams that maybe they only use one framework, but eventually they're going to switch to another one and be able to take that investment again and use it, reuse it is really nice.
So if a multi-framework data grid makes sense to you, please go check out AG Grid at ag-grid.com.
So when you're talking about developer tools, does it run the gamut of saying, okay, I just want something to make my life easier, I'm going to create a simple Node script to do X, Y, and Z, all the way to, okay, there's this developer ergonomic problem that we have that we want to solve, and now we want to create a tool and it becomes a part of the product and it becomes fully supported? Like, is it that whole spectrum for you?
Yeah. I mean, the way I like to think about things, which is probably an oversimplification, but it's like there's this spectrum between useful and simple, right? Or maybe flexible is a better term than useful. So I'm sure you can imagine like some tool that you've used before that was infinitely flexible, that could do any problem. I think Jira is a really good example of a product that's extremely flexible. You can bend Jira to do literally anything you want it to do. However, most of us have complaints about using Jira because it can be very complicated and tedious to get going with, particularly if it's not well set up. So like you got like Jira on one side of the spectrum that's like that, right? And then you have something on the other side of the spectrum. Like maybe the most simple product I can think of is Yo. Do you remember Yo? The it was like that text messaging app, but all you could say is Yo back and forth, right? Okay, it was the dumbest thing, but it got venture funding, right? Huh. So obviously that's the most simple tool. Everyone knows how to use your product, right? So immediately you walk in, there's zero cognitive load and like you're up and running. So from the perspective of fulfilling your product vision, that is the apex, right? And so you need to be somewhere on that spectrum. Obviously you want something that's more useful, more flexible than Yo, right? But you just probably don't want to be more, you know, I don't know.
Like,
I'm spitballing.
Like, hey,
here.
Yeah. Hey.
So our version, you'll just text Yo Jira to someone and then.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yo Jira.
That's it.
That's a $1 trillion idea right there. So trying to find that balance there somewhere on that spectrum of like, this does what I want it to do, but it has the minimum amount of like cognitive burden and things that you have to teach your developers before they can use it. Right. I don't know. It's a fun balance. And generally I try and take like a kind of multi-tiered approach to that, which is going to be more the default easy 95% experience that most people are going to go through is just typically very similar. It's a standard deviation one way or another of some core experience. And we try and make that simple and, you know, flexible enough to cover that 95% use case. And then if you are in that 5% use case, we're trying to get you out into Jira land where you can configure everything and you can, you know, that's going to be for, you know, the DoorDashes and the Lyfts and like those really big companies that have very complicated needs. And, you know, I don't know, trying to strike that balance there.
Gotcha.
What, one of the things that, well, I could say I've liked and probably sometimes disliked about APIs and simplicity is, you know, sometimes you'll have like convention over configuration versus the flip side of that where it's just tons of configuration. Is that something that you actually have to evaluate as you do your thought process through all these? What is it you work on? Like a million different products, it sounds like. So there must be some type of consistency you try to apply to that.
For sure. I try not to. Like I have guidelines, but I try not to apply hard and fast rules to everything just because I want to evaluate every developer issue that I come in contact with. In general, I prefer, I guess it's going to be a mix of both, but leaning more towards convention because like I said, most people's, like if you look at the payment world, right? A lot of it's just like, I'm giving you some sort of good or service and you're giving me money back, right? And that's generally kind of the flow that they're in. And that, you know, it's going to vary by region, how you pay and some of those things, but the general contract there stays the same. But then you have someone like, let's take, you know, Lyft, for example, where it's like a three-way marketplace now where you have a driver, you have a person, and you have Lyft, and the money has to move between all three of those people in various different permutations. That's not a simple contract of you give me money, I give you service, right? And so in that kind of example, I'm not going to set up the default experience to be that everyone gets the Lyft experience, right? This extremely powerful, extremely flexible, extremely complicated system, right? I try and give it so that if you just go through the normal process that you get, you know, I give you good, you give me service, and if you need to break out of that, you can.
So when you're building, you're kind of answering this question I want to ask you already, but like when you're building tools at this scale, like what's the hardest part to get right?
That's a good question.
It is a good question, Craig.
There's a lot of things that are really hard to get right. The first thing is If you go ask a developer right now, let's just take Visual Studio Code, because I think that's a problem that most people understand, because most of us use it. And if you don't, you should. you ask them, like, what do you want in VS Code? What do you want to happen? What do you think should be there? And you'll get a bunch of answers, and you'll find out, like, if you just went and implemented 100% of everyone, what they told you, almost all of those features would be unused, because they will ask you for things that they don't actually want, which is frustrating, right? And I find that is a really common refrain. Like, I'm trying to remember, here's a kind of an arbitrary example of should we build our test runners directly into VS Code? I think most people, if you ask, do you want a thing that sounds cool? Most people say, I like things that sound cool. Yes, I would like things that sound cool. And then you build it for them, and they're like, I hate this, or I don't use it, right? And that's a really, really common thing. And so it's not enough to just talk to people and ask them what they want and build what the people tell you what they want, right? You actually have to go and validate, usually using data, this is a point that when people are using their tools, they're skipping this point, or they deviate from this point, or they drop off at this point, and you have to identify actually using usage patterns that people want that. Then you have to go build an MVP, and you have to put it in their hands and say, do you like this? And usually they'll give you some feedback. Usually it's yes, right? You built them a cool thing. They say this thing's cool. I like cool things. But then you have to watch them use it continually over time to validate that this is actually something they want to continue using, right? So actually a great example of this would be the Stripe shell, the one that I was just talking about. And again, you can just go to stripe.sh if you want to pull it up in your browser right now and check it out. If you ask someone, do you want a CLI in the browser? Everyone's like, hell yeah, that sounds really cool. And we had this cautious approach to it, because it's a heavy lift. It's a big thing to build, right? And so we're still currently in the validation process of is this a thing that is useful to people, and do they like it? And so far the answer has been, yeah, people are pretty into it, which I guessed that, but I really had to go validate it.
You bring up such an excellent point, because before joining Microsoft, I used to do a lot of consulting, and while I wasn't building tools and SDKs and things like that, I was building applications for clients. And it's amazing how many times you would meet and whatever the shiny thing was they wanted turns out to be that really wasn't what they wanted. They wanted the, less shiny thing. But unfortunately, until you learn how to, apply that filter, kind of like you're saying, and constantly monitor and things like that, I think especially for a lot of new devs coming into the business, where you get into a meeting, you have the stakeholder there, and especially if you don't have as much experience, you hear them say that and you take it at face value. Oh yeah, we got to have that. And you don't push back at all. I guess I want to sum up for those listening that, if you are a little bit newer in the field, what Brian mentions is so critical to being what I'd argue good at your job, even if you're not the PM or, whoever it is that's running the project and gathering requirements, having that skill to, separate reality from what they think they want it's a hard skill to develop, actually. So
it is. So I guess that's why I have the question, really for the both of you, is what does that look like with legs? So you've described that, but what sort of questions would you ask? What sort of situations would you place the people you're talking to in order to arrive at the type of answers that you really want?
It's always an exercise in prioritization. You have limited people hours to work on projects. You have limited engineers, PMs, designers. And in a world of infinite people hours, you could just go build everything and try it and put it in front of people. We don't have that, right? Microsoft's probably the closest thing to having lots of people hours, right?
Right.
So it really comes back down to how can you do quick validations of things, right? So I'm working on a project, unfortunately, that I can't tell you about, but it's an extremely large lift for us to complete this project. And it either needs to have a lot of value, and if it doesn't provide a lot of value, then it's not worth the very large lift of the project. And so rather than go build the extremely large project first, what we're going to do is we're going to build basically a cheater version of it, right? We're going to actually go and do the quickest and dirtiest proof of concept and get that into developers' hands, and then kind of hide the fact that it's quick and dirty, make it really polished on the outside. And then we're going to watch people use it for a while. And if people are going to use it, then we're going to go actually hire and spin out a team and do like make a whole new product or to go try and make this work, right?
Okay, so this is running code. It's not like a Figma mockup or anything like that.
Right. It's a real proof of concept that does the thing, but it's a very limited scope to cover a very small portion of what the entire scope of the project could be, right?
So the first thing that comes to mind when I hear that, and this is like interesting decision that hopefully you get to make being in your position, is so now you have what you've identified as quick and dirty code. Does that code stay and you refine it to make it better? Do you get to throw it out and start new knowing what you know now? Like, what's the legacy of that code that's powering that proof of concept?
In this case, it will be thrown out because we're taking a tool that we're going to build for basically all implementations of Stripe, and we're limiting to just JavaScript, right? And that's how we scoped it down to a single tool to work on. I think eventually the final tool will be built in Go or Rust or something very fast, right? But in this case, we're just going to build it directly into JavaScript so that we can just knock it out as quick as possible, right? And so by narrowing it down to just one language, as opposed to we support 7 languages directly and probably 15 languages kind of indirectly.
That's a team of busy.
Yeah, and it's a team of 4 developers that work on the server-side SDKs at Rust. So we don't even have a language or an engineer per language. So I have to be extremely defensive of the time of these engineers. Yeah, in this case, we will throw it out. It's going to vary very widely by project. When I worked at Netflix, when I worked with the prototypers there, they'd knock stuff out. It used to be in Flash when I started, because those people can build stuff in Flash so quickly that it was perfect for prototyping, even way past the point that it was okay to build things in Flash. But now the prototypers at Netflix build stuff in JavaScript, and then they will pass those, you know, quick and dirty JavaScript implementations to the engineer that's actually going to go productize it. And I think they end up reusing a lot of the stuff that the prototyper built.
Are you building a web application? Need to deliver it soon and don't have the people to do it? Maybe you're not sure your company has the skill set or experience to do it. And maybe we can help. I'm your host, Ward Bell, and my day job is building applications for companies like yours. I don't do it alone. I'm president of IdeaBlade, a consultancy that specializes in enterprise web application development. We're particularly strong in Angular, RxJS, NGRX Redux on the front end, and .NET and Microsoft technologies on the server. We're a small, tight-knit group of people handpicked by me for their expertise, experience, integrity, and team spirit. Maybe we can help you with architectural guidance and hands-on development. And if there's something we don't know, and in our field, really, there's too much to know, we can draw on our personal connections in the Microsoft RD, MVP, and Google GDE networks, as well as our international circle of really great developers, people we know and trust personally. If you got a project that's keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at info@ideablade.com. That's info@ideablade.com. And now back to the show.
In addition to some of these decisions you've made from a technical standpoint, I know before we jumped on here, we were kind of the three of us chatting, and you've mentioned you've had this journey from engineering to DevRel to now, you know, PMing this 1,000,000+ projects you seem to have. Let us know. We'll have to set up a GoFundMe, because once you hit 1,000,001, it's going to be like, Brian needs more, resources here. Jeez.
Yeah. GoFundMe for Stripe engineers.
Tell us a little bit about that journey, because I know there's, you know, folks out there who are just starting in maybe engineering, but they want to get into, say, DevRel, or maybe they want to get to the PM role. What's that been like for you?
Different people than me are more intentional about their careers, and they're like, I want to do this, and I'm heading in this direction, and I'm going to get there. And I was at LinkedIn working on a project that I didn't want to work on. LinkedIn's a great company. I was working on things I didn't want to work on. And so I was going to go leave and go do something else. And this is when Sarah Drasner reached out to me, who, you know, John, Sarah, and I were on the same team at Microsoft. Reached out to me, he's like, hey, do you want to come do DevRel at Microsoft? And that's when I, you know, interviewed for John's team and joined John's team. And so I actually didn't set out to become DevRel, but I had been doing enough speaking at conferences and conference workshops and blog posts and podcasts and stuff like that, that I was, you know, accustomed to the public facing portion of that. And so that's when, you know, Sarah reached out to me, he's like, do you want to come try this? And I was like, yeah, you know, I really enjoy people and talking to people and figuring out what people like and use about Microsoft. Sounds really interesting to me. And so, you know, I had been an engineer for probably a decade at that point. So I had a lot of engineering experience and prowess behind me. So at the time, I felt really comfortable taking that experience and offering that to the community, to Microsoft customers and things like that. I'm not saying that they're, that path worked really well for me and not going directly into DevRel. I know people do join DevRel directly from, you know, as their first job. But a big part of my experience in DevRel was sharing my experience working at Netflix and Reddit and some of these hyperscale companies. And so I kind of got to do that for 18 months. I got to go, you know, talk to customers all over the world. And you know, I got to, you know, do customer onsites with 7-Eleven and like stuff like that, which I really, really enjoyed. I kind of found out after about 2 years of doing it that the part of DevRel that I really enjoyed was affecting product. And I enjoyed working with the community. You know, I think I did an okay job of it, but the part that I was really hungry to do was take feedback from customers and apply it to the product. So that's when Amanda Silver, who's a VP at Microsoft of the developer division, posted a position that was working both on the code, a product that I use and love, and being the I have Stripe lingo in my head, person that's directly responsible for the we call DRI, right? Directly responsible individual. Being the responsible person for the developer experience for JavaScript developers on Azure. So cloud infrastructure, developer tools, like you're just checking all of my boxes here. So I decided to go give it a shot. I became a PM at Microsoft. I did that for probably 2 more years or something like that. And I absolutely loved that job. It's hilarious because if you'd asked me, I don't know, 5 years ago, do you see yourself being a PM? Probably like 6 years ago. Let's go six. The answer would have been absolutely not. PMs are, you know, just dead weight on my team and make me do things that I don't want to do, right? But, and then the other thing is like, what do PMs do? They sit in meetings and they answer emails. They're literally my two least favorite parts of my job, right? And now I professionally do that. I got involved in this and the outcomes are addicting, right? Like the ability to like kind of be at a higher level and operate of like steering the ship and like planning out, like, hey, you know, customer, we have this customer problem, we have these potential solutions, let's go research them and then let's go implement it. That cycle is really, really fun for me. And then seeing the outcomes of like, it was crappy before and now it's good, or even if it's just like less crappy than it was before, I love that outcome as well. The part that was really difficult about that transition, and it was difficult going through DevRel as well, is when I was an engineer, I got assigned a ticket and then I closed the ticket and I felt good about myself, right? Like I pushed the commit, I saw it in production, and it was this very visceral, tangible feedback cycle. And it was very it was very short. It's a very short cycle of like I write a code, I write a feature, I push it, I see it. And it's anyway from an hour to 2 weeks to maybe a month, right? But I probably wouldn't go much more than a month of not pushing code to production. When you're a PM, some of these projects take years, right? And it's hard to feel productive because you spend all day sitting in meetings and writing docs and slacking, and you're just like, you get to the end of the day and you're like, what the actual hell did I get to do today? I don't even know. It's hard. That feeling of productivity is drastically different. And like as an coming from an engineering background, that was so hard. That was really, really, and it took me months and perhaps years to figure out really how to cope with that. And eventually you kind of find your way into like, am I unblocking my teams? Are my engineers productive? Are things moving forward? You know, if I look at my past roadmap and my future roadmap, are we, you know, checking the boxes here? And specifically getting really into metrics was really helpful for me as well, because then I can see the numbers that are being affected over time by the things that I hope I'm doing correctly.
So what a good summary of that for people that might feel like you felt, be to have some way to get some metrics along the way instead of waiting 2 years to say, hey, we finally released a production. Thank goodness.
One of the most basic tenets of being a good PM, let's say technical PM, in my opinion, is tying things that you're doing to metrics or tying it to some sort of like achievable goal. Like it's nice to say that you want to make things better, but when are things better? How are they better? Right. And so you want to tie it to some sort of metric. Are we having more adoption? Are users staying longer? Are their sessions longer? Are they paying us more money? Are they paying us less money? Right. Like whatever you're trying to achieve. And the cop out way of doing that is like, well, let's raise CSAT, right? Customer satisfaction. And I'm going to argue for you just a second that CSAT is a great metric, but not in a vacuum. You normally want to tie CSAT with something, right? So if you're CSAT is always like a relative thing. It's this person came to the site and they were mad that something else on Stripe broke. And so they just thumbs down everything. And then they're just trying to put a feedback form to give you feedback, right? And that's a pretty frequent occurrence. And if you don't have a lot of people filling out that forms, it really weighs down your score or weighs up your score, right? So you want to tie it to some sort of metric that's going to inform your, are more people more happy with this, right? And anything that you can do to kind of go in that direction is going to help you get a clear picture of, are your users doing the things that you want them to do in a way that they're satisfied with?
So you've had these two separate types of roles leading up to where you are now. Other than just being able to speak the language of a developer with a developer, what would you say are kind of the surprising aspects about your experience as an engineer and your experience as an advocate that now help you as a PM?
I think something that certainly surprised me and it's both joyful and frustrating is how frequently I'm wrong about things that I think are good ideas, right? And this kind of ties back to what we were talking about earlier of validating your ideas, right? I'm struggling to think of, here's a good one. So we did try app service for Microsoft Azure, right? Which was basically like, hey, we'll give you a free app service, which app service is like, Cloud Compute or Elastic Beanstalk. It's the Heroku. Like that's the Microsoft version. It's like, hey, we'll just give you a free one. You don't have to log in. Here you go. Here's something free. Go try it. And we thought this is a slam dunk. We're going to take over AWS. Well, they're going to be worth nothing and then we'll buy them. Right. Obviously right. That didn't happen. I thought this was a great idea. And that was one of the first things that I worked on. Certainly wasn't my idea. Someone else's idea. I actually don't remember whose idea it was, but we worked on it and I thought it was a slam dunk. And when it launched, it just never got good usage. We publicized it. We pushed it to other people. And it turns out that what I thought was like, the signup barrier was the really the big thing that was preventing people from joining Azure. It wasn't, right? And so that's both fascinating to me, right? Because I'm learning things about, you know, how people think about psychology, and it's so frustrating because you're like, I thought I had a clear problem here. And what I thought was the clear problem was not the clear problem. And so it inspired me to take up my much more investigative lens to these problems, right? And go into every problem, even if I thought there was a clear problem and a clear answer, be like, I'm probably wrong about one or both of these, right? And so I'm going to use data and interviews, both quantitative and qualitative data, to try and figure out how to make things, you know, better.
So what ended up being the answer for you? What was the hindrance?
It certainly wasn't that. I don't know if Microsoft still knows what the hindrance is, right? I guess, I mean, it's growing up into the right. But certainly the Azure extensions was a big step in the right direction of getting more people to adopt, more specifically non-.NET developers, because that's really who I was catering to. And then I saw that Azure just released the Azure Developer CLI, which I didn't know they were working on, but I was pounding that drum the entire time I was there. Like, we needed a different CLI that's not the AZ CLI, which is great. But this actually ties in very nicely to my original point, which is flexibility versus simplicity. The AZ CLI does everything, right? It can manage your entire cloud infrastructure, every part of it from one point, and it's so hard to use sometimes, right? Because it's so infinitely nested. And with this new Azure Developer CLI, which I know Savannah is working on, they strip out a lot of the power of the ACLI, but they made it really simple. And so that's another step in the right direction. They're trying to figure out these kind of, how do we allow developers to get from code to cloud in a very short amount of time? And I think Microsoft is in generally heading in the right direction. Obviously, I have some bias there because I used to work on it, but yeah.
Right.
No, I'll have to admit, for those that haven't seen it, it's amazing. It's like Azure, Azure, dev provision, init provision, up. It's a lot like the Docker Compose stuff, actually, on the container side. But, it uses these things called bicep templates. And anyway, it's a really cool idea.
It's pretty cool.
I got to see an early prototype of that when it was first being worked on. And I was kind of like, yeah. This is absolutely what we need. So pretty neat stuff. It's a good example of what you started off talking about, which is building tools that make developers' lives easier.
I actually built an extremely early prototype of this 4 years ago. It's called AZ Easy. Wow. I'll drop a link in here for you so you can check it out. Because I was thinking about this forever ago. I was like, we just need some sort of one-stop shop that you can just say, I don't care what's in here, just put it in the cloud. Just throw it out the cloud and see what sticks, right?
Right.
I showed this demo to so many people, and it sounds like it finally got picked up and going in the right direction.
So someone finally listened. That's awesome.
Or not. Maybe it could have been converted into evolution. I have no idea if this was any influence, but it makes me feel good to think that it is.
Well, I'm going to go with it. It was.
Yeah, okay. We're going, it was you, Brian.
Yeah.
It was all Brian.
Well, Satya, you know where to find me.
Cool. Well, like we like to do here at the end of the shows is kind of leave everybody with a final thought. So, Dan, what's on your mind today?
My mind. Yeah, my mind is all over the place. That's what's on my mind, I guess. What's on my mind, though, is show gratitude for your health. I don't get sick that much, but I was last week, and it was kind of like, felt like a really, really nasty flu. Let's just say it was COVID related, it looks like. And because I don't get sick too much with the nasty flu feeling, you don't really realize if you're not like that most of the time, how good you have it when you are healthy. And it also kind of makes you realize that, yeah, maybe I should get out and exercise more and eat better and all those good things. So I know some of the folks listening probably struggle with some daily health issues. And, so I guess two parts to my response here are, number one, appreciate what the health you do have, but also be, empathetic to those that are struggling with issues because, you just never know what people are going through out there. That's probably not Absolutely. A great way to end on an up note. But the good news is I'm healthy now.
Yeah, so. That's the up note right there. That's exactly the what note, I was going to say.
Which is why I appreciate it. So,
well, one of the things that I know about Stripe is that they are well regarded in the industry of having excellent guidance and documentation. And the last interview that we had last week was with Mishko Hevery talking about Quick. And I was excited to learn more about it. So I went to the site. And as I was going through the tutorials, I saw a few opportunities where I could put some PRs up to help strengthen the docs there. And so I just say, PRs, feedback on documentation, on guidance, helping clarify the message for a company like Stripe, like Microsoft, for open source projects like Quick. It's such a gift to the people who are building these tools to be able to go in and say, you know, here's a little way I can make it better or fix a typo or whatever. So as you go through these, working with these developer tools or these products, if you see something that you can help out with, please take the time to do it. And I think everybody's the better off for it.
I think those are both uplifting and great notes. And now I'm going to lead in with some shameless self-promotion as I am wont to do. Let's see, this is going to be August 24th, 2022. So this will be pretty close to when this episode comes out. I'm teaching the complete intro to SQL on Front End Masters.
Nice.
Which I'm pretty excited about. We'll be going over Postgres kind of in depth, going from I've never seen SQL in my entire life to deploying your own Postgres and tying it to a Node app. Should be pretty quick and pretty fun. Even if you miss the live recording of it, the live recording is totally free. If you just go to frontendmasters.com on the 24th, you'll actually see it streaming on the homepage. But it'll be edited and posted later behind their kind of pay service, probably a couple weeks after that. So you can check that out.
Cool. That's very exciting. Well, Brian, thanks for joining us once again. I hope we get to do it again sometime soon. And to everybody listening, we want to say we wouldn't be here if it weren't for our amazing sponsors, Ionic, Narwhal, AG Grid, IdeaBlade. Thank you to everyone who supports us. Thanks for listening. And we'll be checking in with you again on Thursday morning, which is where we've been publishing for years. So see you on Thursdays here on WebRush.